and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 605.
That is right. We are jumping straight into Absolute Green Lantern number 3. Should we just head on right in?
I reckon so. I'll try to be relatively brief about, which makes sense, because again, the beauty, I guess, of the Absolute issues is even though we don't really know a hell of a lot. Yeah, we really don't know what the hell is really going on underneath, but the surface level stuff is pretty straightforward for the most part. This is our, I guess we would categorize this as our John Stewart centric issue of the first three. Mm-hmm. So we see the familiar ring in black talking to John Stewart. You must have knowledge to command the flame. You must be without fear, entirely without. I do like the fact that even though we find out he's talking to somebody else, just the fact that he's going, I know, because the fact that Lord knows after 2+ issues, I'm already sick and tired of hearing the mantra of Abin Sur. But John is talking to the guy from this coffee guy,
Todd Rice.
Yes. That and John starts, at least fundamentally, starts figuring out some of the stuff that's going on in was this Evergreen?
Yeah.
Evergreen. That as we kind of suspect here, that number one, it has to do with the color of gold. They don't really say yellow, they say it's gold. So anything that's gold plated, even if it's a piece of crap, just, you know, even if it's like a tin ring with but it looks like gold, will have some effect on the green shield around it. And obviously the more pure gold you get and the bigger the object that is gold has a bigger impact on the shield, including creating an opening that theoretically somebody could get through. So that's how this issue really plays out. When we also find out that there seems to be something about the shield that's covering Evergreen has an effect on anybody approaching Evergreen. They don't necessarily either see the shield or it plays head games with them, so they just kind of turn around and go back in the opposite direction. So the idea that people are waiting there hoping that, oh, it's a matter of time before the cavalry arrives, that it may just never arrive, because to the outside world, there's nothing going on potentially in Evergreen. That's at least like the working theory. So John takes the cheap little ring, that the costume jewelry that was on one of the bikers who ran into the shield, and he throws it through the dome over Evergreen, the shield, and it goes through, and it's able to go through. So that's that gets John thinking, but this is intercut with more stuff between Hal and Joe, and Hal's losing more control to the Black Hand and saying it's hungry for the light. You know, it's like asking Joe, like, can she turn off the green light, because he's having real trouble turning off the black. They end up clashing. He really gives her a really cool shot, but of course she returns this in spades, and she's giving him all this stuff like, basically you have to get your shit under control, everything under control, and that's what it comes down to in this issue, which I don't really, again, we'll talk about this, but Joe seemingly is able to master the green while he's unable to master the black, which you can make a case that makes sense regardless of who's. Even if you switched whoever was black here and whoever was green, it would make sense that the green energy is more easily controlled, even without it being quite the same as we remember. So we cut back to what happened before. John's continuing his theory. So he goes to Joe about Joe's wedding ring, and it was solid gold. So using Joe's wedding ring, that's when they're able to figure out that, hey, if you throw something that's solid gold through the shield, and it doesn't just go through, but it creates like a vortex or a temporary opening where one could step through. So shortly after this, John's trying to figure out, because they're talking about, hey, if we get enough gold and we kind of like all smelt it together, we might be able to create an opening to get out. And this is the point when Abensur shows up and says, hey, judgment in progress, and proceeds to do the Guy Gardner treatment on John Stewart, where he's seemingly destroyed. Hal and Joe are completely freaked out by this. You know, Todd freaks out and starts shooting Abensur, which is interesting because Abensur goes, you know, Todd Rice, judgment is in progress, be without fear, but he does not vaporize Todd. He just kind of flies off. And Hal kind of walks away from all this, and he's like them talking about John Stewart, the man of knowledge, but there's no knowledge to learn, no big enlightenment. We're prisoners in, that's all, trapped in hell, tortured by an alien god, and it's never going to end unless somebody ends it. And we see Hal painting a bunch of bullets with gold paint, which we can take it to the bank will lead to why he ends up having that black hand thing and why he's cursed the way he is. And that's the end of this issue.
Yeah. There's not a lot here.
No.
In terms of Hal and Joe, all we really find out is she can't control it pretty like either. We could have guessed, I assume. And there's just more of the same from him. We don't learn anything new about him and his powers, unless I miss something. I don't think there's anything there. Everything we learn is basically about the shield, and even that is potential psychic effect on outward viewers. And then the fact that gold allows it to penetrate. And we get introduced to a new character. So Todd Rice, and for those of you playing along at home, not technically a new character because Todd Rice is the name of Obsidian.
Yep.
So I don't know. I mean, I guess the only thing to really focus on here is maybe the art, especially the fight scene between Hal and Joe. Really looks great.
I mean, Joe is the best drawn character in the book. John is drawn fine, except he looks more like, you know, hipster beatnik John Stewart, which doesn't really work for me. But he's drawn well. Joe, I think, is the most well-drawn and most attractively drawn character in the book. Again, this probably in this issue, I see a little bit more of how, you know, you kind of focused in on more like Hal looking anime-like. I think that's I think that's definitely more true, or maybe I'm looking for it more in this issue. Again, I don't like where we seemingly are headed between Joe and Hal, and one being able to. Which again, I know, try not to read into, I like Hal more than I like Joe. So having kind of given Hal the crap, you know, the shitty end of the stick, and giving him the black power, which is going to be obviously much more, under any circumstance, much more impossible to control, since it's not just willpower that you would need to control that, even if it was with our understanding of the black power. But I don't, the fact that Hal's, I don't like where they're going with this. I mean, the other thing I guess to mention is a little bit is John's talk about the Philosopher's Stone, because that works I guess, into his theorizing about what's going on here because of the fact that being able to basically turn base elements into gold and that's what he kind of thinks is somewhat going on here, which is still interesting in itself. I'm not sure what that really tells us, because the fact that Abensur is some kind of avatar again of the green, and yet the gold is something that works against the green. And as far as we understand, it's still it literally makes, you know, punctures holes and breaks up the green. So I'm not entirely sure what this means, other than unless they're going to try to really switch this on completely and make it seem like the green power ultimately is more like what we think the yellow power is. In this universe, that the green power is actually more bad or more controlling than and the yellow, you know, the bizarro version of the Sinestro Corps power is actually more the purest power and the more controllable power. I don't know. But either way, it is going pretty slow. I'm still interested. My interest in this will greatly depend on, again, what they do with Hal in this, and if we do get what we expect, that not just John primarily, you know, John you can almost take to the bank, but whether John and Guy end up coming back after having been judged and and things of that nature. But still a good read. It's an easy read. But I think, like with a lot of these books, I think, you know, we're three issues in. I think we need to get a little bit more meat on the bone here, a common thread. This episode was titled The Philosopher's Stone, Al Ewing, Janoi Lindsay, Lucas Gattoni, Julia Necka, Michael Walsh, Nimit Malavia. And those were all everybody, the creators, and Ash Padilla, Andrew Marino, Katie Kubert, and Chris Conroy were the editors. So
yeah, just to read what he says for those of you playing along at home, if anybody is listening to us but not reading, John says the substance that turns base metal into gold, it can also heal wounds, prolong life, create a homunculus, light an ever-burning lamp, and that particular line is given its own panel where it reflects back on that white ring in the blackness. And then it says, it's a symbol, it stands for enlightenment, what is base becomes gold through knowledge. I don't know, that sounds still too cryptic to really make anything of it, except obviously we get the dedicated panel for the ever-burning lamp idea. And then obviously the idea that real gold prolongs the opening in the wall, as opposed to something that's just plated
or looks like gold.
Yeah, the cheap Blue Devil Funko, or what are they Funzo figure.
Yeah, yeah, not the knockoff Funko. But it's also interesting that John kind of notes that it's not necessarily even that it's gold plated. It's just the fact that it just basically has to look like it's gold, and it can still and it still has some kind of effect. It obviously has more of an effect the purer the gold. If it's real gold, it has a much more dramatic effect. That makes an actual opening in the shield that lasts, even if it's for a couple seconds. And the bigger the piece of real gold, then thus the concept that, hey, if you had a big enough piece of gold, that you might be able to not only keep it open, but who knows, if you did it properly, maybe you could get maybe if you couldn't get everybody out, you could get a significant portion of people out. Even though it still makes you wonder, okay, even if you do that, if the shield is having that kind of effect on anybody approaching it from the outside, would it not potentially brainwash the people? And if the idea was to get somebody out to get help, that's kind of a really shaky theory, because once you're outside and the thing closes, you might be brainwashed to not even see the shield and turn around like all those cars.
So, yeah, that's true.
But
beyond that, I think maybe reflecting back, what Hal says about, I told you the Black Hand, it's hungry for the light, angry with it, both. I don't know. Between that and I'm really getting conflicting information based on what the story is telling me and what the solicits are telling me, because the solicits are seeming like Joe and Hal are going to team up in some way, and that there's almost a yin and yang concept at play between their two powers. But that's not what I'm getting so far from what we've been reading. So.
No, I agree. I think the stuff in the book is really making it seem like Hal's going to be the bad guy here, or even if it's not by choice, of course, but it doesn't really matter. He's going to be, and even in the way they're setting this up, in a way, it's kind of like setting Hal to be up like this tragic figure, because he's literally coding the bullets to go after Abin Sur, because not just because of what happened with John, but because based on what all the evidence that's in front of him at the moment, this is about the only way anybody's going to get out of this place alive, is someone's going to basically have to take out Abin Sur. That's the only way it's going to work. So Tal's going to be willing to step up to the plate and do it. So, or try to do it anyway. And again, spoiler alert, the odds are it's not going to go very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, I think, that's it. There's really nothing else to say about it here. I will say, though, I agree with you. It's you. I mean, you didn't use these words, but we're almost, you know, kind of shit or get off the pot time for this series in terms of giving us, I don't know, more action, more information, both. I don't know, because this is supposed to be an ongoing series.
Right.
And again, I need to get off my ass and read on the absolute issues I've banked so far to really compare it against the rest of the universe. But I get the feeling there's more shit going on in the other absolute titles than there is in Green Lantern. and that irritates me a little bit. I want a little more action, a little more advance. And plus, like, the specific plot thread we've got going on with this, the town and figuring out these two powers and all of this stuff, this is going to end soon and it's going to be an ongoing series. But I don't know. There's nothing I'm reading here that's making me feel like we're building a series. It feels like a mini series where there's a mystery to be solved and then we're done. It doesn't feel like a world universe building where I don't know what I'm looking for. That's like, that would be an indicator to me that there's potential for ongoing here, but it all feels so localized to the current problem. I don't really get the feeling that, you know, I'm reading an ongoing series. I don't know.
No, I think I know what you mean. And this is, again, we've seen this before in other books, that this is another problem with basically having, even though this is not like a backup story or anything, but having two narratives, two different stories going on at the same time, even though when clearly they connect, because everything in Evergreen was prologue to what's going on between Hal and Joe now. But because you're dedicating a certain number of pages to the stuff that happened in Evergreen before, and you're dedicating, especially in this issue, very, very few pages to what's going on currently between Joe and Hal, it's just kind of like stretching it on and stretching it on and stretching it on. I still like it. But I don't know. Again, I don't know how much longer either the status quo will intrigue me, or, again, depending on how we get to stuff with Hal, that might kind of be a tipping point for me too. That we still haven't seen why Joe necessarily is chosen to kind of be the avatar of the Green here. I guess that's, like you said, that's coming soon. We assume next issue will be Hal's issue to figure out how he ended up with the, you know, becoming Black Hand related to the bullets. And then after that, we're probably going to get Joe, because we're kind of rolling through these things. But yeah, picking up the pace, or even dedicating one issue predominantly, maybe like 80% to one story, which I guess you could make a case this issue is maybe 80% towards the stuff that happened in Evergreen. But it's kind of hard dedicating 80% to stuff that's prologue too.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. What do we want to talk about next?
Let's do Galactus and Ghost Rider.
Yeah, I talked to, you know, I think it was offline actually with Mark when we were, after we recorded, that the an issue that was coming out, Ghost Rider versus Galactus, just a one shot that J. Michael Straczynski, who is a writer I particularly enjoy, was writing. And I was just, you know, the concept of someone being judged by, you know, their guilt and the pain they've inflicted on others versus that power going up against Galactus, the world devourer, seemed really interesting to me. And I think I even said to you, Mark, I was like, they're probably going to pull some, like, he's a force of entropy, he can't be judged, that type of thing, which we kind of get in this issue. But I wanted to broach the subject. We're not going to recap it or anything. I think it's a good issue. I think JMS writes great stuff, and the art really grew on me. I really love the art in this. At first I didn't, but I read it once or twice and I came to love it a little bit more each time. So I encourage you guys to go out and pick it up. So not only do we get like the atypical origin of Galactus and stuff, you know, the last survivor of the previous universe, and, you know, his hunger and, you know, all this stuff. The Watcher gets involved and stops Ghost Rider from taking on Galactus and explains a bunch of shit. We get information about Galactus not being the only devourer, that in the universe before his, there was a devourer and so on and so forth. It's part of the cycle of the universe and the birth and death of every universe. There is a devourer of some kind whose role it is to do what Galactus does in this universe. And then we also get the concept that he's not just devouring the energy of worlds, he's devouring their memories, their music, their stories, their hopes, their dreams, their emotions, so on and so forth. And then at the end of the universe, is when the devourer of the universe has devoured the last planet. And then the fuel that the devourer has consumed bursts forth, and I'm trying to do this without actually reading it so we can keep this succinct. The fuel that fires the next universe is based on what was learned in the previous universe, and the music and the stories and the emotions and the energy and so on and so forth. And that the idea is this constant cycle is building towards some inevitable perfection of a future universe to be. And I don't, it's a Galactus versus Ghost Rider one shot. I don't know if it's supposed to be a canon thing that Marvel's introducing or whatever. It felt all very emotional spectrum-y to me, in addition to just being some weird new thing that I thought was, like, at a cosmic scale, like a really beautiful notion. But as a comic book reader, I'm like, okay, we've already, like, introduced the idea that Galactus is supposed for some iterations of the Marvel Universe, we've introduced this idea that Galactus is entropy made manifest and that he's just the force of the universe. It almost feels like giving an origin to the Phantom Stranger to me. Like, why did we need to tack on this other stuff? I don't know how you read it. You're more of a Marvel fan, I think, than I am. And I thought this was worth discussing because it, on the one hand, it felt emotional spectrum, reservoir type-y, but also it's just this really obscure, massive addition to the story of Galactus, especially as we approach the Fantastic Four movie in a book I'm not sure is canon or not.
I'm going to assume it's canon. What I did like about this was that it did keep in enough of what I remember about Galactus's origin, along with the fact that it continues the basic mantra that Galactus, at the end of the day, Galactus is Galactus. He does what he needs to do, not because he wants to do it, not because it's at a desire, because it's at a necessity, and he's destined to give back to the universe eventually more than he's going to take. Now, they define that a little bit more here, in the sense that Galactus is not, because it's not just that Galactus will be the spark, basically, to do the new Big Bang and start a new universe. It's that all the knowledge and the art and all the cultures and all these aspects of what made the universe at different points, which you and I did talk about, because we talked about it in the context of the ROM storyline, because I mentioned the fact that how when ROM which started with ROM 25 and it either went to 20. Either ended in 26 or went to 27. That when Ron basically made a deal with Galactus so he'd spare Galador to go into the Dark Nebula to try to take to absorb Wraithworld, but he couldn't because it was too dark even for him to be able to absorb. That when Ron first got into his ship and he saw all these remnants of all these, like these little all these museums essentially, or a one big museum of representing all the cultures in the worlds that Galactus devoured, that Rom's natural reaction was to be, repulsed by it, and he destroyed some of the homages, the legacies. And Galactus pointed out, well, see, everything that I always, basically, there's a piece of everything that I take that survives, and now you've helped destroy some of that. And Rom internally realizes, because he calls Galactus a monster, and he goes, well, what kind of monster am I? Because he's right, he was saving all these in memoriam, some remnants of what these planets and what these cultures were, and I just destroyed some of them. So that it kind of builds on that idea that Galactus is almost like a database too, that he absorbs all this stuff. But I didn't, and I also did like the fact that when Ghost Rider's trying to do his penance stare thing on him, that it has no effect whatsoever because Galactus is completely remorseless, not because he's necessarily a cold bastard. It's just the fact that, again, Galactus is not doing what he's doing, but he's for any emotion, without any emotion, and not for any emotional reasons whatsoever. He's doing what he was basically born to do. What I didn't like was the concept, like you've touched upon, that, oh, Galactus is just like in the long line of devourers, and there'll be devourers after Galactus in the next universe, and that I was less than thrilled with. I understand why you wanted to go down that road. I don't like it. I think that lessens Galactus. I mean, they may not all take the same form and shape and maybe function exactly the same. And if you went down that road, then maybe I'd be more open to it. I don't like the idea that this is just basically, oh, every previous universe had a version of Galactus, even if it was not quite, didn't look the same, but essentially it did exactly the same. And I wasn't as thrilled with that part. I was okay with the idea, even though it is almost like a fool's errand to believe that if we restart the universe that many times, eventually we'll get the perfect universe. Which, of course, does a perfect universe then never end? Because if it does end, then what happens after? And I like the Watcher's role in this. That's not surprising. I mean, even without knowing he was going to be in it, I assumed the Watcher was going to be the one that was going to basically have to call off Johnny Blaze and say, hey, you don't understand what's really going on here. I did think it was interesting that the Thing was the one who basically told Johnny, hey, if you can do this to this piece of crap thug criminal, how about doing it to Galactus? That's a little borderline ethically, too, but it was at least out of the box thinking by the Thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, you know what? What did you think of the art, by the way?
I wasn't a huge. I thought Galactus looked fine. I thought he looked fine. And I guess for the most part, the Watcher looked fine, even though his, you know, again, his head's always oversized. But in some panels, it just looks ridiculous. It's not really my art style at all to this. And it's very colored pencil-y. That's how it looks. I mean, yeah. It looks like it's less inky and more colored pencils.
Which is really cool looking to me, I think.
The stuff when they're in space is certainly cooler than when Johnny's on Earth and dealing with the Thing before and after. And, you know, Galactus looks good. Doesn't look 100%, you know, one exactly classic Galactus, but close enough. I do like the fact that the way Galactus just kind of ignores them once they get their final literal face off when he tries to do his penance stare on him, and it has no effect whatsoever. And Galactus says, okay, this, I'm done here. So he goes back to doing his own thing. I do kind of like the fact that, you know, it's like, I got things to do. Goodbye.
Yeah, I see. It's just weird because I feel both sides of the argument in this one. Like, if it's really true that, you know, the deaths of all these planets mean something because their lives weren't in vain. The music, the art, the knowledge and everything that they gain does serve a higher purpose. Like that, there's some elegance in that, in the same way people find comfort in things like religion and things like, you know, like there's some cosmic beauty to that. But also I get what Ghost Rider is saying, and it is literally one bubble. Galactus doesn't get a free pass just because of something that might happen a trillion years from now. He can be destroyed now, and I don't care what happens in a trillion years. All I care is what happens right now. And that's right. Like how many universes have to die to reach perfection? How many? God, I don't know what's the highest number I can even think of right now. How many? Whatever that is. How many that times a trillion lives are sacrificed just to have a universe of perfection? Is that really worth it all? I don't know if I buy that.
I think it's a tough concept. And let's put it this way. It would give you no comfort at all if your world was scheduled to be devoured to say, hey, on the bright side. But but when you look at it from the perspective that in order for there to be another universe, that Galactus has to exist and Galactus has to do what he's doing because he's going to be the catalyst. I was thinking about this. It kind of reminds me of one of the 8,000, of course, versions of what did Crona do? It's like I had a funny reference, but it slipped my mind. So it has to come back for me to use it. So that there have been so many different versions of what Crona did when he looked back at, you know, at the beginning of creation, that the reality is that we know one of them was because when Crona did that, he linked the beginning of the universe with the end and all this energy was lost. In this version, that was part of the reason why the Guardians were so anal about everything being controlled. And their goal was to limit chaos and anarchy and everything in the universe to try to have it run as smoothly as possible. Because if it did, the Guardians believed they could basically make up for the amount of energy that Crona lost, thus enabling there to be enough energy at the end of this universe existence to create a big bang to bring about the next universe. So it's a very similar kind of concept to that, that Galactus needs to exist. And then they just kind of magnify it by saying, well, he needs to exist because the universe is on an endless makeover quest, and eventually there's a chance it might get it exactly right. So I do think at least they're consistent. They are consistent with Galactus. And I do like the idea the Galactus is essentially a force of nature, that he's not. Now, obviously, we know Galactus does have some personal stakes and cares about this and that. He had affection for the Silver Surfer. He had affection for many of his heralds, not all of them. Like, obviously, Terax was a douche, and he kind of knew that all along. But, you know, Gabriel the Airwalker, he had a special fondness for besides the Silver Surfer and things like that. So he's not devoid of any capacity for emotion, but he's not doing what he's doing, generally speaking, out of emotion. And that's part of the reason why if you play Let's Make a Deal with him, it's like, hey, if you save this, if you spare here, how about this? That he's willing to do the deal, mostly because it's just everything's just a stepping stone to the ultimate goal. So it doesn't necessarily matter what order you go in, and as long as he's getting something, that's what he needs. I'm okay with most of it. I like I said, the only thing that bothered me, if anything, was the idea that, hey, there's like a countless series of Galacti that came before, which is kind of like how we keep getting introduced to the concept of, hey, there's the first lantern, and there's these first Green Lanterns, and then there's other first Green Lantern. It's like, come on. It's after a while, it's like, pick a hill and die on it already.
I think it's just the notion that Galactus is the reason universes die, and that the purpose of it is to build towards perfection, because one of my favorite movies, and it's not like in my top five, probably top 10, would be Contact. And in that movie, you know, the idea is we're a young planet and that everybody goes through the cycles of selfishness and corruption and greed. And, you know, like the idea that we will reach to the stars and reach beyond our own selfish means and so on and so forth is a life cycle that every species has to go through and things like that. And I don't know. I just really like that concept just philosophically, I suppose. But to me, this kind of goes against it, because it's like the only way perfection exists is if we build on the previous universe. It's like, can't perfection exist in this universe? Like, let's say Galactus didn't exist. Can the universe still consist? Yeah, sure, the life cycle of a planet would probably die out and things like that. But other planets, based on, you know, newly formed systems and things like that, gravity, new planets are being formed all the time and things like that. So as we leave one planet, we migrate to another, we interact with other species, we become an amalgam of cultures and ideas, and can't perfection be reached that way as well? Like, it just, I don't know, it cheapens the ultimate goal in multiple ways to me.
I can understand that.
That's it. I just thought it was just a unique concept that sort of tied into Green Lantern in a way and shook things up a little bit for the Galactus stuff. And since we're approaching Fantastic Four's film and Galactus is involved, shocker, you know, it was worth discussing. So we'll move on.
All right. And I'll have a tie into Fantastic Four here, too, when I delve into this. So what has Mark seen, again, as we continue to release these a tad out of order based on our GL June release schedule, that we're actually, so we're recording this on June 11th. So this was right after the weekend, after the week after Ballerina opened. So Ballerina is the movie that I did see last week. And Ballerina has obviously suffered from a box office perspective. It has suffered the same fate more or less as Karate Kid Legends, as both movies were supposed to open up in the 30s originally. The projections were, and they ended up opening up in the 20s. And not surprisingly, based on the fact that this is a female-led action movie, that the analysis to and the discussion about why this movie has ended up where it did is certainly a lot different than Karate Kid. But generally speaking, before I go back into that, I enjoyed it. I thought it was worthy of being in the John Wick universe, and obviously John Wick is in the movie, which they made no bones about smartly in the trailer to make it clear that he wasn't going to be in the movie. That I think it fits from a mythological perspective. It fits in well. I think they do a good job, even though they kind of borderline jump the shark at once or twice. And this is going to go into the analysis part, that they do a good job of trying to. They're clearly not really trying to girl boss her. They're not trying to Mary Sue her, where she's just as good as John Wick, or she's better than John Wick. And I think they give you reasons why, realistically speaking, she's not going to be John Wick. And not just because of her gender, though her gender, that her gender factors in, because she's always going to be per capita weaker than anybody, any guy that she's fighting who's skilled as she is. She's going to be an underdog because she can't go toe to toe with him. So that's why this movie isn't quote unquote girl bossing. So they're not going to give you this 4'9" girl who weighs 88 pounds soaking wet going against a 6'7", 350 pound guy who is at least as skilled as she is, if not more, and they just basically have a fist fight and somehow she wins. So they don't give you that garbage, and they kind of give you the explanation that she has to use her weakness as her strength, and of course vice versa, trying to use other people's strengths as their weakness. And something you will probably appreciate, that looking at it from the Batman Begins perspective, she kind of Ra's al Ghul's things a lot in this movie, because she's constantly aware of her surroundings. She has to be aware of her surroundings. So she will use, I mean, John Wick did this too, to a certain extent, but she's really good at using whatever around her. So like, if they had this big fight scene in a diner, I mean, she would be jamming like a pepper shaker up your nose and a Heinz bottle in your ass or something and things like that. Because that's what's available to her. So she's very flexible when it comes to using weapons and making it clear that she has to rely on what's around her much more than, let's say, John Wick has to. But along with her experience level, she's just not very experienced. So when she has the inevitable confrontation with John Wick in the movie, if people were afraid of the girl boss thing, they figured, oh, she's going to fight him to a standstill, maybe actually even beat him and he's going to live only because she's not, you know, basically she lets him. And that's not what goes on in this movie. Clearly, they make it clear that John Wick could take her out in 3 seconds if he wanted to. He just doesn't want to for various reasons based on the story. But I think that factors into when people are trying to figure out why this movie didn't do as well. That there's multiple reasons why. Obviously, if you fall into the side that always is looking to say, point fingers and go isms and ists and things like that, then it falls all on the fact that, oh, male moviegoers won't support female action heroes, even though there's a lot of history that says that's not the case. I mean, nobody had problems with Natasha.
Kill Bill.
I know, but you are correct. But even in recent times, actually Black Widows are perfect examples, both Natasha and Yelena, because what do they do when they're fighting people who are not ridiculously superior to them in either skill or strength? They're able to do a good job and usually beat them. Whenever they go up against super soldiers, they get their asses kicked all handily. I mean, Bucky beat the crap out of Natasha multiple times. It's not even a contest. So they give you a realistic context to Black Widows can do. So, you know, Black Widows go up against somebody who, again, they're like 6 foot and they're moderately trained and they are ridiculously trained and have tons of experience. And they will probably be able to take those people out relatively easily. They're going against, the further up the food chain you go, Black Widow's effectiveness are limited. And that's what this movie kind of establishes. But we've seen a lot of examples in movies and things in which that's not been the case. So I think that it's deeper than just saying, oh, man, which is completely unfair, too. It relates to like Alien and Terminator and things like that, where females, strong female characters have always been accepted if it's done in a realistic fashion. I think part of it, why people might have stayed away, is also number one, you have to be honest, John Wick is not the biggest money-making franchise of all time. It's gotten better. It's been kind of trending upward, like in a Fast and Furious way from part four upward. But John Wick, you know, a huge opening for John Wick is a very poor opening for an MCU movie still at this point. So there's that. It's not a huge money-making franchise. It's not a true traditional spinoff because we haven't seen this character before. There's still talk of multiple spinoffs that they may do from John Wick from characters we've actually seen before. This isn't like that. And this isn't like where technically the movie was already made, but we saw Black Panther in Civil War before his movie came out. So we were already introduced to the character. This is a new character in the world. So it's a spinoff because it exists in the same universe, but we don't know the character. And I think there's also an element of probably the boy who cried wolf in this too. It's the fact that even though it's not a girl boss thing, There's reason for people to have been cynical to say, oh, everything I just described, what you thought this movie might be, and oh, she's going to be just as good as John Wick, and she can fight John Wick. That's what probably people were afraid of, and this is where our Silver Surfer thing comes into play, because we have talked about this before, too. It's kind of like the MCU heading into Fantastic Four. even if the only reason they decided to use the nobody cares about it, barely anybody knows, Shia LaBeouf version of the Silver Surfer was because, A, they do have plans for Norrin Radd. B, those plans are not coming anytime soon. They don't want to necessarily cast the role and then put the actor on ice for a while and maybe have no choice but to recast, or then feel like they have to recast because we used this one in this universe. We should get a new one. Even if all of those reasons were the only reasons they decided to do a Shia LaBeouf version, which was a one-off, we're never going to see this character again as the Silver Surfer, boom. They're not going to get the benefit of the doubt, for that's why they did it, because we've seen them gender swap and MCU stuff for like the entire phases 4 through 6 up to, into entering 6. So they're not going to get the benefit of the doubt, even if that's what they did. And I think that could be factoring in to some moviegoers who were a little nervous about maybe they were going to make, you know, Ana de Armas the ultimate, you know, girl boss, even though it kind of sucks for her because she's really good in everything. I mean, she was on the best parts in their small cameo in that last James Bond movie, which kind of proved that she could do a role like this. And I don't think it has anything to do with people not liking her, because people liked her in Knives Out. And there's a lot of movies that people like her in. But I think it's a little deeper. This is the non-Occam's Razor thing. I think there's a lot of reasons why this movie probably did not achieve what people thought it was going to. But it's good. I would certainly recommend seeing it. If you like the other John Wick movies, you're not going to certainly dislike this movie.
Touching on the Shia LaBeouf stuff real quick before we move on to my other point. I if the reported reasoning for them to choose her is true, or the rumored reasoning, either or, I kind of like it because it establishes the role of the Herald in the universe as just being a role. And then by the time we do see Norrin will be the next Herald, and we know what the role is, but then because of his own unique brand of compassion and his origin and so on and so forth, and what he ends up doing, he will be a character unto himself as opposed to just a Herald. So I do like that. But do you think part of the reason there might be some fatigue around this movie is just the what I'm going to call universification of every successful franchise that's come out in film in recent years? Like every time we have a successful movie followed by a successful sequel, it's got to be a franchise. We've got to build a universe around it.
I think there could very well be some of that. I think also that show they had released on whichever platform, The Continental, seemingly did not go over particularly big. People didn't like it. But I think there's truth in it. I think we know that John Wick, people like John Wick, and they like movies with John Wick in it where he's the star. That the question remains, because I know they want to do the spinoff of the Donnie Yen character, Kane, who was in Chapter 4. And that would have been a more of a traditional spinoff. And I think there's still talk about maybe doing something with Halle Berry's character from, I think, what was that, 3? Parabellum, I think that's the part she was in. But it still remains to be seen if this is viable enough where if John Wick is not the focal point of a movie, whether there's enough meat, again, using our term, this is our phrase for 2025, meat on the bone, whether there's enough there to really keep this, to keep the interest going. Now, it's a shame on some level because, again, John Wick is in the movie he's not like, he doesn't get like 40 minutes of screen time, but he also doesn't get like 2 minutes of screen time. He's on screen. I mean, they space it out, but he has a major role in like the final 20 minutes of this movie. And plus he does have an earlier cameo, you know, in the beginning when the Eve character first sees him. I guess this movie chronologically takes place somehow between John Wick 3 and 4 that. And he's in the movie and he does John Wick stuff and it's important. So it's almost like if they had wanted to do this, they probably would have been just better off introducing her as a supporting character in like the next John Wick movie and going the traditional spinoff route, because if people had liked her more or gravitated towards her, kind of like the Hobbs and Shaw thing, which is another traditional, you know, spinoff routine. It's like, hey, two characters, they were in the main movie, in the main franchise, supporting characters, people like them. They already had their established relationship, so spin those two characters off into their own movie, and it did very, very, very well. But I do think there's a great chance that, yeah, it's debatable whether the John Wick universe is big enough to support all these little spin-offs here and there. Plus, for better or for worse, And I say that because it may very well have made the movie significantly better. But the fact that they reshot a lot of this movie, which is part of the reason why this movie's budget was up to $90 million. When if this, let's say this budget was only like $50 million, then even now, as this movie is not doing tremendous box office, it may very well have still been had a very it may have had a very easy or a much clearer path to profitability if the budget had been lower. But because they reshot so many of the action sequences, which may very well have made this movie as good as it is, because it does fit into the John Wick style of combat and action, I think more than the original version before they reshot it did. So
speaking of it being shot, the action, what about like just like the camera work? Because the John Wick films have like a very specific way in which it follows the action. It tonally, and I mean tonally color wise, lots of grays and dark blues, and it's somewhat dark film and stuff like that. Is it shot like cinematically, like it would visually go in the same universe, or does it have its own look?
That's a good question. It's harder for me to answer since I think I've only seen literally all. If I've seen all three of the John Wick, actually, I've never seen John Wick 1. I've never seen all of John Wick 1. I'm trying to remember if I saw John Wick 2. I know I've seen 3 and 4. Those are the ones I absolutely know I saw in the theater. It's harder for me to say that. Are there a lot of elements in this movie that are dark? I mean, as in physically, yes. I would probably say it very. My instinct is to say yes, which would make sense because basically the creator, the pseudo showrunner of this franchise, is the one who came back to do the, by all accounts, to come back and reshot many, if not all, of the action sequences. So you would expect there to be a lot more continuity in this version than maybe how it was originally put together. I do think it does follow that style. Obviously, there's a lot of creative scenes in this movie with using different weapons. Have you seen the trailers? You saw the stuff with the flamethrowers and stuff. And it's a lot more to that than what you've seen in the trailers, and just, you know, dishes and all these different things that get used, and a really creative car crash sequence that literally comes out of the blue. Cause you kind of think you're transitioning out of one actions piece and you think it's over and you're moving on, but it actually just kind of continues in a different way, which is kind of cool. They introduce Eve as a good character. I mean, and whether people are going to, I mean, she's not going to be John Wick and people aren't going to like her like John Wick, but would she be a cool character to at least see show up in another John Wick movie, not necessarily getting a sequel? Yeah, I think so. Is the plot overly original? No. Even is there, you know, does the way the movie ends, is it overly original? And no. But I think it's good. I think it deserved a better fate. But like I said, I think there's a bunch of reasons why this movie just didn't necessarily reach the heights. You know, the heights, to be fair, were only going to be like in the mid 30s. It's not like they were projecting this movie to do like 50, 55 million or something. It was only supposed to open up in the mid 30s. It opened up in the mid 20s. But I would recommend, if you like the other movies, I would say go see it. It's fun. It's a fun movie, and the stuff with John Wick is cool for multiple reasons. And the returning characters that you see related to the Continental and things like that, it works. It creates a nice little sub universe exploration of that we haven't really seen in other movies. So
gotcha. Well, not taking as much time as Mark dedicated to that, because of course we have an entire episode that Jim and Corwin and Mark did about this film, but I saw the new Captain America. Finally.
And not worth the wait, was it, Chad?
the wait was inconsequential. It was just a matter of getting around to seeing it. But like, just, I don't know why they revealed the Red Hulk and everything. Like, Did they take a look at the film they had, regardless of reshoots, and just go, you know what, we're not actually not going to capture anybody's attention unless we do this? I don't know. The Black Widow-ish character seems okay, but I didn't really feel any attachment to her. Like, I don't expect to see her in Doomsday or anything. I don't really feel her as part of this universe.
I thought, you know, the I thought the stuff with, you know, with Cap was fine and everything, and his new Falcon character, I didn't mind him either. So it was nice to see that. But this, you know, and I think honestly, my favorite character arc or whatever, in terms of seeing where they were, where they are, where we maybe expect them to go, would just be what's his name, Isaiah. Like I see where we saw him in the show. I see where we put him in this movie, and it's almost like the show didn't matter because with Isaiah in particular, it's like, oh, he's accused of crimes and tortured or imprisoned or whatever. And then like, oh, in this movie, he's accused of crimes and imprisoned and, you know, like all of this stuff. So, and then part of the Bucky and Falcon show was like, oh, I'm not worthy of the shield and blah, blah, blah. And getting through that whole bullshit, only for in this movie, Cap and Bucky to have the same conversation, but only in the span of like 5 minutes to end on a joke. So like, I don't know. You know, there's obviously more carryover a little bit from the Falcon and Winter Soldier show in terms of like, I should have taken the serum and like all of that stuff. But like, I don't know. Cause I did enjoy the film. I didn't hate the film. I just feel like, especially given how late we see Red Hulk and getting that reveal and how quick that's over, did they vision this whole thing and show us more than they should have, more than they needed to? Would it have performed better if Red Hulk was a reveal that got word of mouth and people to go see it in the second and third weeks? Like, I don't know. It just feels largely inconsequential, aside from maybe setting a couple of chess pieces in terms of Bucky running for office, this new Falcon character, Isaiah being free and everything and being cleared, not just, you know, internally, but publicly, you know, and everything. So maybe he can be our like trainer of the new Avengers. This idea that you know, Ross wanted him, Cap, to set up a new Avengers, and that was a sincere ask. So putting that in the water, like, it's doing something for the MCU, but is it doing enough that it was worth a film? I don't know. I gotta admit, like, yes, this is gonna sound like a well duh sort of moment, but cinematically speaking, the sequences around the Celestial Island were fucking awesome because I forgot realistically how big the Celestial was. So them flying around it or piloting boats in the water around it and everything, like it's just like you forget how massive a fucking Celestial is compared to the surface of the planet, and the fact that his hands and fingers, you know, like a piece of his palm is like, you know, partly underwater, but his fingers still reach up above the fucking clouds. Like, that's how insanely huge this small piece of the Celestial that appeared out of the ground it actually is. And of course the whole adamantium of it all as well. But like, I don't know. I think it was a better than movie than some others in these later phases, but not by an insane margin.
No, I mean it's a fine line, because there's so little that's really 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 good in phases 4 through 5 as we're about to enter 6, and it's kind of hard to separate the stuff that, I mean, because off the top of the head, when you're looking at the stuff that's bad, the stuff that comes to mind, you know, the Eternals and the Marvels, but this movie is very similar to the Marvels. I mean, it's the magic word we used, serviceable. It's serviceable, and much like the Marvels, considering how it was hodgepodge together and reshot and recut, and how they tried to market a movie that they kind of knew there was really not much of an interest for. They succeeded in more ways than you would have expected they'd be able to. But it is, I started watching it again on Disney Plus the other day, and it's like, it didn't take too much. I didn't take very long before I fell asleep, and not just because I was tired. It's like, it's like, really, there's not a lot for me to rewatch here other than forwarding to maybe, like you said, the stuff around the Celestial Island and then getting to the very end with, you know, Red Hulk. Other than that, there's not a lot to really go back and rewatch, especially since we know they completely cut and butchered the Serpent Society plot. They completely changed that out. They changed the look of the leader. His role in the movie was really stupid, but they did, considering he was wrong so much of the time. The guy was supposed to be all about probabilities, let alone.
Yeah, a particular instance I noticed is, even though like he had a plan for Bucky and for Cap and the Falcon to, you know, when they found his hideout, like he had preventative measures to keep them from following him. It was almost like he was surprised they were there to begin with, even though he called the phone knowing that the guy would be unconscious or whatever, expecting Falcon to answer. What did you think Cap was going to do with the damn phone? Of course he was going to use it to trace.
Yeah.
How are you surprised? How are you at all surprised that he found you, let alone how fast he found you? He had the phone in his hand that you used to contact this other, he's a part of the Serpent Society or whatever, the what's his name's role?
Oh yeah, I know who you mean.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. Like, you called the phone. Like, what did you think he was going to do? Do you think he was just going to go, oh, conversation over, leave it with the unconscious guy? It's a piece of evidence. You're going to use it to follow the trail. What the hell are you thinking? You can't predict that. I could predict that.
There's really not much to, there's not much to say, really. It was disappointing. Thunderbolts is much better. But it's going to be difficult to see. It'll be not difficult. It's curious to see what Fantastic Four is going to do. And I don't really care how well the early ticket sales were, because I certainly don't care about, hey, temporarily these ticket places crash. We know the ticket places basically crash is because their infrastructure sucks. And they don't do anything to increase them, because in all honesty, they only have movies that will test their infrastructure, if they're lucky, once or twice every few years. I mean, and even so, I mean, I had no trouble getting Fantastic Four tickets. I had no trouble getting Superman tickets today. If this isn't like Spider-Man No Way Home, when the friggin' thing opened up Sunday night into Monday morning and all the ticket sites were down for like 4 to 5 hours from like midnight to like 3 or 4 in the morning, you couldn't get into anything because it was all crap. This wasn't like that. So I want to see what Fantastic Four is, considering that we know they did public screenings of Fantastic Four, which they almost never do. Which is not why they did the reshoots. They did the reshoots because of the internal screenings, which obviously they all pointed to the same problems with the ending, since the ending is what they've been focused on fixing. But they did public screenings recently. That's what everybody's been talking about, and that's been acknowledged that they did that. And it's one of those bad it's like a bad company to keep kind of thing, because the other movies they've done very few, and the ones they have done it for, and I think this is an exclusive list, but don't 100% hold me to it. I just know that the ones I'm about to say have had it, that they did it for the Eternals, they did it for the Marvels, they did it for a Brave New World, and I thought there was another one they did it for. Oh, Quantumania. So needless to say, this is not the group of movies, if you're Fantastic Four, you really want to be associated with, because those are all losers. So which doesn't mean this movie will be a loser, because a lot of people believe that the main reason they did this was because they were blindsided by what happened with Thunderbolts, because they were completely confident Thunderbolts was going to be a much bigger hit than maybe probably the tracking numbers indicated originally. Because they were so confident in the quality of the movie, you know, as opposed to a movie like this, because they knew Brave New World wasn't particularly good, just like the Marvels wasn't particularly good. You can only polish that turd so much. But they really thought, oh, we got a winner here with Thunderbolts, so we're going to be in the, you know, we're going to be in the clear. But it didn't work, even though we got good critic reviews and good audience scores for the people who saw it. So that supposedly panicked people at Marvel that maybe we can't afford Fantastic Four to go down the same route, so we have to do everything we can to try to fix it and make it as good as possible. Whether it works or not, we will have to see. But yeah, it's kind of critical since they're 0-2.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, before Mark closes us out, one final thing. We wanted to remind you that GL June is still ongoing. As this episode comes out, the Emerald Echo podcast over with Donnie and Adam should be out already. If not, maybe even Will's over at the Green Lanterns podcast. The whole thing started with the podcast of Oa. We're talking Green Lantern Corps Recharge. So listen to their episode. Listen to our episode about issue 2. Listen to Emerald Echoes about issue 3. And maybe even as you hear this, Green Lanterns podcast will be out over at Will. And I know at the end of the month, around the 30th, Dan will be releasing his finale to the whole event over on his YouTube channel at Mosaic Comics. So all throughout the month of June, from start to finish, people are releasing content in connection with this. So check out those other shows.
Yes, please do, so we can have a very successful third GL June to roll on to whatever next year holds for us, assuming that we're still here doing this. God help us. Please, Dan and Jim, take it back. Please, just for Jamie, please take it back. When he starts hitting these 600 episodes, if nothing else, he'll be pleased because of him being name dropped every episode from now on, from here to eternity. all right. So lanterncast.com. The email is lanterncast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook. Use hashtag GLcast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail or a text, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.